And it is my honor to introduce our last speaker, although certainly not least. Dr. Sydney Madsen is a breast surgical oncologist at the University of Utah. She was born and raised in Cedar City, Utah. She attended undergraduate at the University of Oregon, medical school at the University of Chicago. After completing her residency at the university, she did a fellowship in breast surgical oncology at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Her research interests include shared decision-making, doctor-patient communication, and patient-centeredness. She also lists one husband, two kids, two cats, two dogs, and one fish.
All right. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak this morning. I do not have any relevant disclosures. So the previous talks are a perfect segue into the final discussion, which is about shared decision-making and the choice of breast surgery. And I would propose to you that shared decision-making may be actually part of the problem, which has been evidenced by some of the things we've talked about already, but is also the potential solution. So what we're going to be discussing next is, well, what are we defining as the problem? What is shared decision-making? What are some elements of shared decision-making that might be contributing to the problem? Specifically, we'll talk about decisional responsibility and differences in patient and provider views. We'll talk about efforts to improve the shared decision-making process that might be part of the solution, and this will include a discussion of decision aids, and we'll end with some provocative questions. So I won't have quite as much data as in some of the previous talks. We'll be talking more about concepts and approaches to the decision-making process. But I'd like to start with some things that I think we can all agree on. The first is that guiding patients through the breast surgery decision-making process is one of the most difficult parts of our job. I think we all try very hard to do this well, but we know that there's some tension between what we want and what the patients might want. So these are the big questions that all the previous speakers have been addressing. The thing we have to grapple with is the rising rate of mastectomy, particularly bilateral mastectomy, a problem? Who decides what is too many? Is it us? Is it our patients? Or is it society? And it's been clearly demonstrated that these different stakeholders may have very different answers to this. We have to recognize that there are some conflicts of interest that exist amongst the stakeholders. But in the end, if as a profession we decide that we think this is a problem, what can we do about it, and what are we willing to do about it? Because I think those are two different things conceptually. So we've mentioned shared decision-making several times throughout this talk or throughout this panel, but I think we need to understand what it actually is. So shared decision-making is a decision-making model that is best used for preference-sensitive decisions. So decisions where there are multiple options with similar outcomes but different consequences. And a great example of this is breast conservation versus mastectomy, or unilateral versus bilateral mastectomy. It's the preferred model of decision-making in the American Society of Breast Surgeons guidelines for decisions around contralateral prophylactic mastectomy. And it's a concept that's very easy to talk about but is actually very hard to do well. Part of what makes it hard is that we don't all understand exactly what it means. There are multiple definitions of what shared decision-making is, but almost all of them go something like this. It's a collaborative process between patients and clinicians, mutually engaging to align clinical decisions with patient values and preferences. That sounds easy, but it's not. There are some common elements among all the measures of shared decision-making, and these include preference elicitation, information gathering and sharing, risk assessment and communication, balanced presentation of options, and defining the decision or deferment process. And the goal is to have decisions made using the best available evidence that are aligned with patient values and preferences. So this is just a basic model of shared decision-making. And you can see it's a dyadic model. It includes the provider's decision preferences and the patient decision preferences with mutual information sharing and mutual deliberation that ultimately leads to a decision. Now, some of these aspects have been better studied than others. The patient side of things actually has been more well studied than the provider side. One of the patient decision preferences that has been well studied and is important is decision role preferences. This is one of my favorite quotes about decisional responsibility and shared decision making. And I think it's important to emphasize that decisional responsibility and shared decision making are not the same thing. Shared decision making takes into account, among other things, the extent to which patients want involvement in making decisions. Patients may well want to be informed about options without necessarily wanting the entire responsibility for decisions. And shared decision making takes this into account. So what I'm saying here is we also contribute to this process. It is not only patients who are making these decisions, and they may want different roles in this process. So we know that they might desire different levels of decisional responsibility. This is the foundation for the decision process, and yet it's something that we don't often talk about with our patients. Role preference is associated with different socio-demographic factors, but these alone are not predictive enough to warrant not talking about this. We also know that as providers, we have preferences also for what role we want to play, but this is much less studied. From the patient side, the way that this is typically measured is with something called the patient preference scale, which is shown here with five different roles represented. There are two active roles where the patient prefers that they take primary responsibility for the decision, a collaborative role where they prefer to share the responsibility with the provider, and passive roles where they prefer that the provider take primary responsibility. When we look at this in breast cancer patients, it generally follows a normal distribution in terms of what role they prefer. About half of patients do prefer to have a collaborative role, but about a quarter prefer more active roles, and about a quarter prefer more passive roles. And the distribution of role preference has been associated with things like age, nationality, ethnicity, education level, and income level. And this is a bit of an aside, but it segues into the next topic, which is that preferences and perceptions are different. And what patients prefer may be different than what they perceive actually happened. And we call this decision role concordance, and it's actually only about 50% in most studies. But I think this is because role preference is actually dynamic and contextual, and so perhaps we're not asking appropriately about this, because when you ask at different time points in the process, it may look like discordance when it's actually just evidence of preference change with more information gathered. So rather than asking what role do you prefer prior to the visit and what role did you play after the visit, a better question would be, were you involved as much as you wanted in the decision-making process? And role perception is actually where we have more evidence for how this might affect mastectomy rates. So this is data from a retrospective survey of 1,800 patients from the LA and Detroit SEER database in 2002. These are patients that had unilateral DCIS or invasive cancer, and they were asked a median of 9 months after their surgery what role they played in the decision-making process. And what this graph shows is the percentage of patients that had mastectomy and bilateral mastectomy predominantly, according to what role they thought they played. So in patients who perceived that they were more responsible for the decision, they were more likely to have mastectomy. Now, this particular study did not ask if the level of involvement was what the patients preferred. It only asked what they perceived. And again, it was done retrospectively after surgery. We wanted to take a different look at this, and so we actually looked at this prospectively in our institution in a small study of about 100 patients with invasive cancer. We asked them immediately after their visit with the surgeon, so prior to their surgery, but after their visit with the surgeon, about what role they perceived they had played in the decision. And our results were a little bit different. What we found was that patients who perceived that they had shared in the decision, or patients who perceived that the surgeon had primarily been responsible for the decision, were more likely to have mastectomy. So what this demonstrates is that patient perception of increased responsibility has been associated with increased mastectomy rate in some studies, but the timing of the survey may impact the answers. And this is likely due to things like recall bias. Further down the line, patients may recall the process differently than when it just immediately happened. I think there's also some social desirability bias. In America, at least, it is more acceptable for us to say, no, I chose to do this to my body, rather than saying someone else influenced my decisions. And also, as Dr. Plikta talked about, responsibility for the decision may also feel like control over the disease. But this begs the question, so who is responsible for the rising rate of mastectomy? If patients are responsible for the decision, then they're also responsible for this increasing rate, right? But I would say that even if they feel responsible for the final decision, we know that patients are not making these decisions alone. Surgeons are contributing to the decision. We know that their family and their friends are contributing to the decision. And society at large has also been mentioned, including the influence of celebrities. And I think this has led to some cultural acceptability. I think it's almost expected at this point that a woman who is diagnosed with breast cancer will at least think about bilateral mastectomies. So we know that this dyadic process that's happening between a patient and provider is happening in a larger context of family and friends and society. Now, we don't have time to go into all of the data that's around that, and we're still just going to focus down on the provider and the patient. But it's clear that providers and patients may think different things matter when making these decisions, and this has been mentioned by some of the previous speakers. So we looked at this in surgeons, and this is just an excerpt from this survey, but we surveyed 536 breast surgeons who are members of the American Society of Breast Surgery and asked them to rank the three most important factors when recommending a contralateral prophylactic mastectomy. The things that came out on top are things that you would expect in terms of the surgeon's perspective on future risk and possible benefits from these procedures. And what we cited was the lack of survival benefit and genetic testing were the two most important factors in making these recommendations. Patient anxiety fell somewhere in the middle, and things like limiting the need for future imaging or increased number of future operations were at the lowest end. But we've already talked pretty extensively about what it is that patients think about this and what matters most to them when making these decisions. There are multiple surveys that have been done of patients, and the most consistently cited reasons are surgeon recommendations, the possibility of omitting other treatments such as radiation, which obviously only applies to the ipsilateral breast, and then anxiety about recurrence or new cancers or the peace of mind concept. And one of the questions we have to ask is, well, is this anxiety due to a lack of appropriate risk information? And maybe there's a way we could improve the information given, and maybe this would help them understand risk in a better way. And so one of the things that we've thought about is, well, are decision aids the answer? A decision aid is a tool that provides patients with evidence-based, objective information on the treatment options. They're intended to present the risks and benefits of all options and help patients better understand how likely it is that those benefits or harms will affect them. But there's some big questions about whether they actually improve shared decision-making and whether they can change decisions in breast cancer surgery. In a large review of decision aids for people facing health treatment decisions, they looked at 105 studies with about 31,000 participants across disease contexts. They analyzed for effects on knowledge, accurate risk perception, informed values, choice congruence, decisional conflict, participation in decision-making, and satisfaction with choice, as well as the actual choice made. And they found that there is good evidence that decision aids do improve knowledge of the options. Patients feel better informed and more clear about what matters most to them. They probably participate more in decision making, but there's a variable effect on the option chosen depending on the choice being considered. When we look at this in breast surgery, there's mixed effects. There's some data to suggest that decision aids might be associated with higher rates of breast conservation, but some studies show no effect at all. These differences are likely due in part to things like which decision aid was used, when it was used, and how it was used. So my take on decision aids is that they can help, but they are not the ultimate solution. I think what they do is they improve preparedness, so patients have better knowledge, they feel more informed, and they feel more clear about their personal values. But whether or not it impacts shared decision-making is a little bit questionable. I think that they improve the information sharing and deliberation processes, but it's unclear whether or not they can actually impact the decision that's made. And I think that the qualitative evidence that was shared earlier also demonstrates this. So how do I think shared decision-making could help? I think part of it is we need to understand more about our role. We need to understand how our behaviors as providers interact with this process. And I think we need to develop adaptable communication strategies to better meet the patient's needs. On the patient side, I do think that we should implement the use of effective decision aids, but I also think we need to improve our preference elicitation from patients. And I think of this as kind of, you know, thinking globally but acting locally. So we can act at the individual level to affect population level trends. So is it the solution? Well, it might be, but it's very messy. So it's part of the solution, but it's not easy or simple. So there's some provocative questions that this can raise. So if the rate of mastectomy is a problem, are we as providers willing to be more vocal about our views? Are we willing to say no? That is way easier said than done on an individual level. I know when we're sitting with a patient across from us, it is very difficult, even if we feel that they wouldn't have a big benefit, to actually say, no, I don't want to do that. And if we say no, can we really say we engage in shared decision making, or does this amount to paternalism, which as a profession and a society, we've really moved away from that model, and we don't think that that's an appropriate decision making model. If we say yes when we don't want to, can we really say we engage in shared decision making? Or are we then just acting as technicians? So my thoughts are these, that patients value our opinions and our professional expertise. We should value their personal expertise. I think patients deserve to know what we really think, even when it makes us uncomfortable to tell them. And this is that question, what would you do, doc? And we get asked that all the time. We know we have our own preferences, biases, and values, but we need to better understand these and how they influence our recommendations. What would we actually do? I think we're in a unique position to change trends in surgery choice, but it will not be easy, and it requires special attention to ethical concerns, particularly around how persuasive do we really want to be. And change may require structural changes to our systems to help us disengage from what we would term low-value care. So, you know, is it easier to say no if the insurance company says no? So, in conclusion, shared decision-making is a complex process that can be difficult to achieve. Patients have different preferences for how much decisional responsibility they want. Patient perceptions of decision role may be associated with the choice of surgery, but we know that patients and surgeons differ in the factors that drive their decisions. Decision aids can increase knowledge, and this may influence the choice of surgery. And I think we as a profession can take responsibility for our role in the current rate of mastectomy, but we can also work to find solutions to improve our care. Thank you.
We'd like to take questions from the floor, and if you come up to the microphone, please introduce yourself and just tell us where you're from. I will open up the questions, I think, for Dr. Madsen particularly. I find it very interesting that I have this long discussion about patients regarding the risks and benefits of contralateral mastectomy. The patient walks out of my office stating that they understand all the risks and benefits. They have chosen unilateral mastectomy, and then they go home, and then their friends and families then convince them that they're doing the wrong thing, and they come back actually completely confused or have shifted their whole decision making. And I just want to know what your comments are regarding that.
Is this on? Okay. Yes, I think this is a very common situation that we have all dealt with. So we feel like we have had this really in-depth discussion. We've engaged in shared decision making in a very meaningful way with this patient, and we think we've come to the final decision. But then they go home, and there is a much larger context that this is happening in. And I think that it relates to some of the things that Dr. Plikta was talking about with the qualitative study, that when patients get home and they start thinking about risk forecasting and thinking about decisional regret in the future, and they start talking to their family and friends about that, it becomes much less about numbers and statistics and about the information we've given, and much more about how they feel about what may or may not happen in the future and what kind of regret they might have. And the reality is, as human beings, we're very, very bad at understanding what our future regret might be. But at the same time, it's not that it's not important. And I don't know exactly what our approach... I haven't been able to figure out exactly what our approach should be for that particular situation. Because you don't... One thing could be, well, have the patient come back in. Let's have another conversation. Let's go into more detail. But is that really going to change things? And so I think that we need to do a better job of addressing a lot of the things that that were talked about in terms of what the real future does look like, what are the real consequences of what's going to happen, but also helping people feel really comfortable and confident that they make the right decision for themselves and not always listening to all the stories that get told to them by everybody else. Because we know that every story, every cancer story, is as individual as the patient. And it's a difficult problem.
And I think probably also the education of the general population continue to do that as well, because that may influence what their family and friends actually think.
I think that's absolutely true, because their family and friends didn't hear the conversation.
Right. Microphone one.
Hi, my name is Jennifer Foster. I'm a general surgeon in Mountain Home, Arkansas, which is a retirement community. And I have a large Medicare population. I was wondering about the cost analysis. Did that include all future care for that patient, like a projection of future mammograms for the contralateral side? Because I see some of my patients that have the unilateral mastectomy reconstruction and end up getting a procedure on the contralateral breast for symmetry, like a reduction.
So I think that's for you, Dr. Shankar.
Hello? So there have been a number of studies that have looked at cost, and for the majority of them, they have looked at costs in a variety of time frames, 1 year, 5 years. There certainly are costs associated with the contralateral procedure, which are factored in, at least on the index case of that procedure, are factored into the cost. And many of these actually include costs associated with reconstruction and so on, because they do have a time frame of a year to 3 years to 5 years. But you're quite right. There are additional costs associated with tweaks of the reconstruction, complications, reoperation rates, etc. The contra, however, is in looking at the cost savings in the long term of imaging, additional cancers being diagnosed, chemotherapy and radiation, etc. So I think in the main, while there are increased costs associated with contralateral prophylactic mastectomy in the short term, there really haven't been a lot of studies, at least to my knowledge, that have looked at this over a lifetime and have balanced it against the screening costs, the costs of the additional cancer, and the prevention of that.
Thank you so much.
Back microphone.
My name is Abu Hanna. I'm from Albany Medical College in Albany, New York. I'm one of the surgical oncologists. First of all, I'm going to share my thoughts with you, and then I'm going to ask questions. You raised the question of how to say no. I have had occasions where the patient not only didn't need contralateral mastectomy, also did not need unilateral mastectomy, i.e. microinvasive breast cancer, DCIS, where I had to counsel the patient to the point to say, it is not medically indicated. You do not need contralateral mastectomy. I'm afraid you may not need unilateral mastectomy. You will be well served just with breast conservation. My question to you or anyone on the panel is, if a patient decides to have breast conservation and later on comes out to be they have deleterious genetic testing, and that particular patient opted to have breast conservation earlier, given that information that comes out later, would they opt for unilateral mastectomy and or bilateral mastectomy as the time goes along? It was not available at the time of their diagnosis and the decision.
It's for you, Chris.
Dr. Mattson, do you want to start with that regarding... Oh, okay. Dr.
So I think you're Your question was, what do we do with the patient that gets genetically tested after the fact? Well, I think what I mentioned earlier in my talk was that the timing is actually very important. So, for example, when I counsel patients for genetic risk that have breast cancer, I tell them basically that if they're going to use the information to make their surgical decision, then we need to get the test now. But if they're unclear that they're going to use that information, meaning whether they've already decided they're having bilateral mastectomies or they're going to stick with breast conservation, that's fine. Then I tell them we can get the genetic testing on the back burner because it does take some time to get those tests and results and move ahead with their cancer care. If they choose later to have their genetic testing and they find out they have a mutation, again, I give it to them as the choice. We can continue in high-risk surveillance like we would for their breast cancer initially and then take over for the genetic and just follow them along. Or if they want to go to the operating room at that point for bilateral mastectomies, that's fine as well. I leave them the choice because, remember, we don't have a lot of data about the risk for that contralateral breast over time. And it depends on how old they were when I originally diagnosed them with breast cancer and genetic mutation.
And I guess I'll elaborate on that particular question, too. So if you have sort of a paternalistic approach to this and say, you know, you will not gain any medical benefit from doing more surgery, and then that patient comes back with a second primary or a recurrence in the same breast, and they kind of say, why did you tell me this? I mean, so that kind of goes back to the decision-making process, and how do we manage that?
Sure. So again, I think that this gets to the issue of decision regret and how much and why it is that I think decisional responsibility allows patients to feel like they've had more control over the disease, because if they feel personally responsible for the decision, then they're more likely to say, well, I made this decision, and so I'm okay with whatever the outcomes are. It gets a little bit trickier when they say, well, I didn't want decisional responsibility. I asked you to make the decision. You made this decision for me, and then something bad happened. I think that, first off, I think, you know, it rarely happens, fortunately, but it will happen sometimes, and I think part of the problem is that those patients don't always go back to their original surgeon. A lot of times they'll go somewhere else because they feel in some way that they have been let down or perhaps led astray, even though I don't think that's what happened, but they may feel that way. And I think that it's important that in all of this, we continue to recognize that decision-making is not just about numbers and statistics. It's about feelings, and it's about how people perceive what happened, maybe not what actually happened, but their perceptions of it. I think it's a difficult situation, and I think that if they do come back to their original surgeon, I think first off it says they still trust you, but also I think that it says that, you know, none of us are perfect. Whenever we talk about the risks of these things happening, there's no zeros or hundreds. It's always somewhere in between. And I think that patients do understand that. I mean, that gets to that whole idea, like they don't get peace of mind because there's not a zero. And so I think that if we've had a really good conversation with them up front where they truly do understand that there is a small risk no matter what we do, when they come back, they're going to feel bad and we're going to feel bad. But I think we can, again, mutually engage in a productive and meaningful decision-making process to move forward. And that's the best we can do.
Thank you. Front microphone.
Hi, Aaron Blesnack, Norfolk, Virginia. First of all, thank you all for the talks. Very provocative. I'm sure I will be ruminating over this for days to come. A couple of thoughts, and I'm going to try and frame them in terms of questions. First of all, you know, there's really two parts to it, and I think really the last speaker did the best job teasing them apart, which is one, the decision between lumpectomy and mastectomy, and second of all, then the decision between unilateral mastectomy and bilateral mastectomy. And we know that there are surgeon differences, which I really didn't hear discussed much today. I'm also curious as to whether there is any data on the impact of not so much just obtaining an MRI, but the equivocal MRI result, which I seem to receive when I order MRIs about half the time. A completely negative contralateral MRI, in my experience, has dissuaded women from a routine or a prophylactic contralateral mastectomy unless there's another reason. But I don't get those very often from my radiologist. So, A, surgeon, any data on surgeon differences and contributions to this, and on the radiologist's impact. And again, there was no discussion about plastic surgeons, but it seems to me that when I have a patient looking at a unilateral mastectomy who sees a plastic surgeon, they come back saying, well, I think I'm going to have a bilateral mastectomy done. The only other thing that I would add would be, again, feeding off the last comment, when patients do have regret, the regrets of patients who have mastectomies seems to be much more virulent. And nowadays, of course, ends up on public media. So I don't want to claim false news, so that's not my intent here. But, I would say that the exciting things that go into print and go into TV are bilateral mastectomies. It's much more intriguing to the public. So do we, as professionals with professional organizations, have an obligation to try and counterbalance that? You know, a woman who goes in and has a breast-conserving surgery, radiation therapy, endocrine therapy, does great. That's not the stuff of TV. So is there an opportunity for us not to just publish position papers, but actually take a somewhat stronger stance? So thank you.
Dr. Shagpar, do you want to answer part A?
Sure. So with regards to the MRI question, there are data that people who have had an MRI, particularly with equivocal findings, will have a higher rate of CPM, even if those equivocal findings have not panned out to be cancer, even if they haven't been biopsied. Simply having an MRI with equivocal findings, even if they're a BI-RADS 3, follow-up in 6 months, will lead to a higher rate of CPM. So you're quite right. MRI may be associated with a reduced CPM rate if patients are going in with the idea that if I come out with a completely negative MRI, I won't do a contralateral prophylactic mastectomy. But as you know, the chances of finding that is incredibly rare given the sensitivity of the test. And I think that speaks to the American Society of Breast Surgeons choosing wisely guideline now not to do routine MRIs. And so it'll be interesting to see whether, in fact, we as a community of surgeons will abide by that choosing wisely guideline and we'll see MRI rates come down. And if so, will the contralateral prophylactic mastectomy rate go down concomitantly? With regards to your other piece of Part A and surgeon variability, there have been some data with regards to that, albeit less, to suggest, as we talked about, that physicians bring their own bias to the conversation. And so some are far more prescriptive and may say to patients, you don't need a mastectomy, you don't need contralateral prophylactic mastectomy, you should have breast conservation. Others are far more liberal. And certainly that does play a role, particularly when you merge that with the proportion of patients who will defer their decision-making to their provider and will give that some weight.
Anybody else on the panel want to comment on those questions?
I just want to also add about the surgeon decision. I mean, we're basically all trained with the understanding that survival is the same whether they have breast-conserving therapy or a mastectomy. But I think what happens is that geographically, parts of the United States have more of one operation versus the other. I mean, classically, the Northeast is a breast-conserving therapy region of our country. But as we move south, I can tell you for sure in Florida, over 50% of the patients will come in and say, I need to have bilateral mastectomies. And it could be for a 3-millimeter ductal carcinoma in situ. And you're thinking, is that absolutely insane? And I can tell you for sure, even at our institution, none of my partners will bring up the concept of a contralateral prophylactic mastectomy or choosing a mastectomy over breast-conserving therapy. It is always the patient, and the patient will always say things like, well, all of my friends had that operation, right? Because if that's what you see, that's what you assume is the correct way. Mm-hmm. So I'm not really sure that it's the surgeon in many cases that's the driver. It's what's in their local region. And when we were at MD Anderson, I could tell you for sure 80% of our patients chose mastectomy over breast-conserving therapy. Anise was after me, so maybe it changed by the time she got there, but when I was there.
I'll try to make a quick comment because I know I can be long-winded. But I would say that, yes, there is evidence that there's surgeon variability in terms of mastectomy rates. I think there's multiple things that contribute to that. I think we all do have our own individual approaches for how we have these conversations, but I think we try to relay similar information, but it may be the delivery that is quite different, and that may have an influence over the perception that the patient has of what actually happened. So saying words like need or should may be different than saying you could think about, or we couch it in different ways. But there is evidence of surgeon variability, but it's far less studied.
Back microphone over there.
Hi, I'm a general surgeon from Southern Arizona, and I'd like to illustrate a case that I encountered, and it mirrors what the panelists on the far left just said. I wanted to get the opinion of whether the panelists would do a bilateral mastectomy. I had a 31-year-old female with two first-degree relatives with breast cancer who came in and wanted a prophylactic bilateral mastectomy. Her physical exam was negative. Ultrasound was negative, mammogram was negative. I tried to get an MRI, but the insurance, of course, denied it because she had no risk factors. I declined the surgery. She went down the street to another general surgeon, and that general surgeon performed a bilateral mastectomy. Pathology showed a microfocus of DCIS. Patient said, aha, you refused my bilateral mastectomy, you denied me care, and went on health grades and made negative comments. So my question to the panelists is, I'm quite sure none of you would have performed a mastectomy in that case, but what do we do in cases like this when we have the public that the pendulum has swung now to almost a radical view that even if I have a negative mammogram or a negative exam and if I have a family history, I want a double mastectomy. By the way, I failed to mention the patient tested negative for BRCA. I did BRCA testing. It was negative.
So I would say we all know that there may be consequences of saying no. And there is actually a good study, again, in the LA and Detroit SARE databases looking at if you say no, does that increase patient dissatisfaction? And they actually found that it doesn't amongst that population, but that's retrospective. There's probably a lot of biases that are involved in that. I think that in the end, as individual providers, we have to say, well, I have to feel comfortable with what I said. And if you truly feel like this is not someone who you would recommend it in, this is not something that you feel comfortable doing, you should say no. You can't control what the consequences might be for that patient and what they might say on social media or what they might say on these different websites, which is difficult. But I think that in the end, you have to be able to sleep at night with the things that you've recommended. And so if you felt very comfortable with your recommendation, see if you can talk to your hospital administrators about purging some of the health grade stuff because it's not relevant. But hopefully what it's evidence of is you're a thoughtful surgeon who sticks with your values, even if sometimes they're contrary to what the patient might want you to do.
And I'm just going to add, when we make decisions, I think that you practice evidence-based medicine to the best of your ability. And so patients can demand head-to-toe MRIs, right? They can demand, some bizarre test that has no evidence. And it disturbs me when particularly young trainees who are just getting out into practice will say, well, if I won't do it, then they'll go down the street and somebody else will. That's no reason to do it. You practice evidence-based medicine and surgery to the best of your ability. So she ended up with a 3-millimeter DCIS. She might have had that anyways. That's potentially over-treatment and over-diagnosis. And I agree. I wouldn't let all of the, negative comments, et cetera, weigh on me at all. Because you did what you felt was in the best interest of the patient. So what if they went down the street and somebody else did something else?
I believe that negative social media comments will potentially come out of any bad outcome or difference of opinion and outcome. So I'm not sure that particular case really made the difference. Maybe if you had done the surgery and she had a bad outcome, you would have been, they would have had some comment on social media anyway. So I think that social media has made us vulnerable in some ways. I mean, it has a lot of good effects as well, but clearly makes us vulnerable at the same time. Microphone.
Can I wanted to add two things. One is, since I work a lot with our high-risk population in our high-risk clinic, I order a lot of breast MRIs, and I have some tips on getting those paid for, so if you want to talk about that afterwards, I'm happy to. And my other comment that I wanted to make is I went to this talk recently that was actually by somebody in marketing where they talked about decisions and patients do better or people in general do better when they have 3 choices. And so it may not apply to this woman in particular. She seemed pretty dead set on what she wanted. But when we present patients with options of 2 extremes, then they feel like they have to choose something extreme. But if we can give them something in the middle, I don't think maybe you would benefit from bilateral mastectomies, but I understand your concern. Maybe we could watch you very closely and see you every 6 months and get imaging and give them something in between so they're not doing nothing, which is probably what she felt like was her alternative to bilateral mastectomies. You would give her a choice in between. And I think presenting people in general with a third option that's not at an extreme can sometimes be helpful for them. Again, not sure in your case it would have helped, but maybe in some patients it does.
All right, we'll take these last 2 questions. The microphone in the back first.
Can I just add to that? I'm sorry, because that's a really great question. The other thing I would suggest, because it actually gets to her third choice, is that just because your patient was BRCA negative, you mentioned she had 2 family members with breast cancer. I would suggest to her to get those 2 family members genetically tested, right? If those 2 had a positive test result, then the odds are she's not going to get an inherited breast cancer or has a lower chance of regular breast cancer, correct? But if they tested negative, then you cannot interpret in her family what the risk is for an inherited breast cancer because you can't find anybody with a genetic mistake. And so, again, that's sort of finding that middle ground that may better assess her own risk.
And I think the other thing, just to Christine's point that she made in her talk, you mentioned that you had her tested for BRCA 1 and 2. You always have to remember, if she is young, she's got this family history, could there be another mutation? Was she seen by a genetic counselor? Did they evaluate whether a panel would be helpful? And I think that particularly in people with very large family histories, you always have to think about whether they've got BRCA 57, right, that we haven't discovered yet. So things to keep in mind.
Okay. Again, back microphone. Sorry.
Yeah. Kim Keller. I'm in North Houston, Texas. I've been in practice for 30 years, a solo practitioner, general surgery. I actually was the second opinion on a 55-year-old lady that had a stage 1 breast cancer. Diagnostic workup, she didn't get a MRI, but her mammogram and everything was okay. The surgeon that I know very well, he only did the single mastectomy. She was came to me for a second opinion. She was adamant that she wanted a mastectomy on the opposite side. So I did proceed with a simple mastectomy. And actually, unfortunately, in her case, she did have an invasive ductal carcinoma with microinvasion. I did not do a sentinel node on that patient. So I have a couple of questions. What would you do in that particular patient as far as her axilla? And the other thing is that I found that mammogram with contrast is easily approved by the insurance and is more specific than MRI. And I didn't know whether any of y'all have any experience with that.
Who wants to take that?
So you were saying in the contralateral breast she had a DCIS with microinvasion. Is that what
The prophylactic side had right. microinvasion of DCI of invasive ductal with microinvasion.
Okay. Well, we'll all get opinions on this. So axillary management, as you know, is one of our favorite things to talk about. But I would say that I would not go back and dissect her axilla. I think that the ipsilateral side that was the original diagnosed cancer that you did the sentinel node on, that is still probably going to be the more, the higher stage or the more aggressive cancer that should drive her treatment. The incidental cancer that was found in the contralateral breast is going to have very little impact on what her treatment will be, because we know that the axillary staging is just that. It's axillary staging. And I think she's been adequately staged based on what her diagnosed cancer was. I would not go back and do anything in the contralateral axilla. I don't know what you guys think.
I agree.
Yeah, I agree. Especially if the ipsilateral side was more than DCIS.
Yes, it was stage one. So it was, they were very similar cancers, but yeah, the obviously the symptomatic side was larger. And any comments about mammogram with contrast?
Any comments
about what?
Mammogram with contrast.
Oh. I was going to answer also about the sentinel node part. So when we do a contralateral prophylactic mastectomy, the incidence that's been reported on multiple studies is about a 3% chance that some kind of cancer is going to be found in that breast, an occult cancer. The vast majority are going to be DCIS. And if we're in the era of the learning curve and everybody had sentinel node, regardless of if it was a fibroadenoma in their breast, for God's sakes, then what you found out was that for the vast majority of the case, it was probably less than 1% of the time that the sentinel node was positive. And the biggest predictors of a positive sentinel node when you find an occult cancer is actually the cancer on the other side, whether it involved the skin or they had bulky disease in their axilla, so it was actually a crossover metastasis.
Yeah, with regards to enhanced mammography, I don't know about the rest of the panel, but the data are that it seems to be a promising technique. It certainly is not something that we use at Yale. We are in the era of tomosynthesis, which I find is very helpful. I do not routinely use MRI. I think that enhanced mammography may be a cost-effective alternative to MRI, given the data. However, that is not in widespread practice, at least not at my institution.
Okay, and then
I agree.
Want to close up our last question.
So I'm Gene Riley. I'm actually a trauma and critical care surgeon outside Philly, but I'm one of the breast people for our indigent clinic. And this was really enjoyable. Thanks for all the great provocative questions. I couldn't help but think, though, that to the extent that peace of mind drives a lot of this, that a lot of it is kind of self-imposed by the medical community. My observation has been that there's so much innumeracy, fundamental innumeracy, both on the patient side and the provider side, that when we talk about risk, we're really bad at that as human beings anyway, but we aren't helping. And I think the surgeons are really in a bind, in particular because a lot of that conditioning has happened before they ever got to the office, just in trying to convince the women why they should even get screened. Or why they should have that biopsy for sort of the marginal screening study, it's a little hard to backpedal then and say, like, well, you're almost certainly destined to die from something else. Like, that's not a very convincing argument. And so, like, when U.S. Preventative Services Task Force came out, agree with or disagree with what their new recommendations were, it wasn't completely unreasonable. But instead, my observation was that a lot of the reaction from stakeholders and professional societies was that they were recommending bringing the Salem witch trials back. And so I don't know how to, at the risk of sounding like I'm rambling, I'm curious to hear your opinions on if there's anything that we can do to change the fact that I don't think we are doing a great job of helping progress that conversation.
So let's have one panelist answer that question. And if you want to talk with anybody after the session, that would be great.
I'll leave that to Anise.
Okay, so I think that you're quite right. And I think it comes down to this dichotomy between the data and the feelings, right? So people have been inundated with this fear of breast cancer, get yourself screened, save lives, it's a fight, you know, battle cancer, rah-ha, versus, well, here's the numbers. The risk is very low of anything bad happening with this. The probability of you having a contralateral breast cancer is less than 5% or whatever it is. You can work out the numbers with your patient. And I think that that conversation takes a lot of time, and particularly with the healthcare system that we're in now, those conversations can be somewhat abridged. So to your point of what do we do, I think that we have an extended conversation, very much like the USPSTF. I mean, they were right. The data support mammography between the ages of 55 and 69 biannual. I mean, that is the optimal screening standpoint. There are 8 randomized control trials that support that. And the age trial actually did not show a survival benefit in patients at the age of 40. But because patients were primed, right, get yourself screened every year starting at age 40, we have to get over that with the data, and that's just going to take time.
All right. For those who are remaining from our last session, thank you very much, and I appreciate our panel. Fantastic job. Thank you.